The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, if you thought, yes, some of last year's flight disruptions were bad, and aviation experts say it's going to get a little bit worse this year, because it could be because of a new study that reveals North America will face an aviation mechanics shortage. So I'll speak to an industry researcher about the problem. Also, the head of a local school is trying to train more aviation mechanics. Plus, creating space for people of color in the wine industry. It's big business, but it does have a diversity, equity, and inclusion problem. So we'll talk about all that. Those conversations coming up. But first this, if approved by the city council, it will be a record investment for city services like infrastructure, economic development, and public safety. That's what Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens is proposing in part of his fiscal year 2024 budget. Now, in the proposal that will go to the city council, Dickens called the $790 million, quote, our statement of intent to double down on the progress we have made and our commitment to making Atlanta the best place in the nation to raise a child. The proposed $79 million general fund budget is the largest in the city's history, close quote. Now, that includes more than $8 million for the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, a combined $6.2 million to get vehicles and equipment for police and fire personnel, $10 million toward continued premium pay and implementing a citywide cost of living adjustment for the second year in a row. Also, more than $1.25 million in new technology to support innovation across the city, and what the mayor calls the establishment of Atlanta's first ever Department of Labor and Employment Services, and also $10 million in capital improvements. In other news, as Georgia faces turnover from some local election officials, 20% of those now in that position nationally, well, they've never worked a presidential election before. And that's from a recent survey by the Brennan Center. And also, as we hear more from WABE's Sam Greenglass.
Since the 2020 election, Cobb, DeKalb, Fulton, and Gwinnett have all had their election directors depart. The Brennan Center found that 30% of election officials reported being abused, harassed, or threatened because of their job, and 45% say they're concerned about the safety of their colleagues. 56% say they're worried about politicians interfering with the work of election officials, and 74% say they need more funding to meet the new security and admin demands now placed on election offices. Georgia election officials, of course, were targets for false claims about election fraud after 2020. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
Georgia's ban on abortions at roughly 6 weeks of pregnancy may already be causing a dent in the physician workforce. Most doctors continue practicing in the states where they complete their training, but there's new data that suggests, presented at a U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee hearing recently, that states with abortion bans are seeing a drop in medical residency applications to OBGYN programs. At the hearing, Georgia U.S. Senator John Ossoff said the state's six-week ban could worsen the state's existing shortage of OBGYNs.
More than half of Georgia counties have no OBGYN at all. No OBGYN. In more than half of the counties in our state.
And a programming note, we will have some extended coverage about this issue on future programs of Closer Look. Georgia Power customers will likely see their bills increase again in June. State utility regulators this week are considering another rate hike to cover fuel costs. Don't blame me. Listen to Emily Jones.
The cost of the coal and natural gas that Georgia Power uses to make electricity has gone up, so the company says it needs to charge customers more. The utility and the staff of the Public Service Commission have agreed on a plan to increase power bills by 12% in June, nearly $16 a month for a typical residential customer. That's less than the company initially asked for. But some advocates say the system of passing fuel costs directly onto customers is unfair. They argue Georgia Power should share the cost of fuel because the company chose to use gas and coal instead of renewable power like solar. The commission will vote on the fuel charge later this month. It's the latest in a string of rate increases scheduled to hit Georgia Power customers over the next 3 years. Emily Jones, WABE News.
Georgia is moving forward with new guidelines to support businesses from underrepresented communities within the state. Marlon Hyde reports the new law makes obtaining necessary goods and services easier for some companies.
The bill, signed into law recently by Governor Brian Kemp, helps the process of procurement for all businesses, with a focus on minority, women, and veteran-owned businesses. The aim is to help in the selling of services and buying goods, including construction services, equipment, and vehicles, among others. Supply chain issues combined with inflation have made it more difficult for some small businesses to get what they need when they need it. Supporters of the bill say this will ensure that underrepresented businesses can be well-equipped to compete for state contracts. Marlon Hyde, WABE News.
And finally, the NFL draft is over. All total, 10 more UGA football players are now part of the league. And it was the Philadelphia Eagles who selected three of them to join the two Bulldogs, a team drafted last year. Now here's Eagles general manager Howie Roseman on ESPN discussing the immediate chemistry from picking players from the same university.
They can go to each other and say, hey, tell me how this works. Tell me about the city. Where should I live? Where should I go? A lot of the things that maybe we take for granted when we're talking about the draft process, that now they have people to rely on. They have people here that they know have their back.
Should call them the Philadelphia Bulldogs then. Meanwhile, Georgia Tech had defensive lineman Keon White, send me your emails, selected in the second round by New England. And Kennesaw State defensive lineman Travis Bell was drafted in the seventh round by the Bears, Chicago. By the way, former UGA quarterback Stetson Bennett was taken by the Los Angeles Rams with the 128th overall pick in round four of the draft. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. If there are two words that most travelers hate, it's flight delays. But look, they're common, and there could be a number of reasons why. Air carrier, extreme weather, national aviation system issues, late arriving aircraft, and security. And now, at the time of this broadcast, Monday, May 1st, according to FlightAware.com, this is what happened yesterday. Nearly 800 flights were canceled, and about 9,000 were delayed across the nation yesterday. Perhaps you were part of that. And here in Georgia, Atlanta, Hartsfield, Jackson had 33 canceled flights and 350 delayed. I promise you, the rest of this conversation will get better. Hang with me. Well, now comes new data, but it's not right now. Another increasing issue, the aviation industry is forecasting an even bigger problem this year. The start of an aviation mechanic shortage. It's a problem that's expected to keep growing and reach its peak by the year 2027. So, here's some questions. How did the U.S. get to this particular workforce crisis, and how bad could it get? Well, let's first welcome Brian Prentice. He's a partner with Oliver Wyman, the management consulting company that conducted some research. Brian, welcome. I hope this conversation gets better.
Rose, thank you so much for having me. I think it does get better, and I'm looking forward to it.
Well, here's what stood out to me regarding this research. I'm going to quote you all here. Quote, a shortfall of somewhere between 12,000 and 18,000 aviation maintenance workers in 2023 in North America. The imbalance between supply and demand will persist and even worsen over the next 10 years. Okay, tell all of Atlanta and Georgia and where else. How did you all come up with this? How were you able to get this information?
So we spent about 6 months actually interviewing both airlines and MROs, maintenance, repair, and overhaul centers, third parties that do work on aircraft, and combined that data with FAA licensed airmen data. Mm-hmm. So we were able to understand exactly how many. There's about 150,000 or so licensed technicians working in the commercial airline space in North America today. We were able to understand how many technicians are there. And then we do an annual aftermarket forecast report that we've been doing for about 20 years. So we understand the demand side. And what we see is that in North America, you know, the number of aircraft operating, the number of flights operating is going to continue to grow and continue to increase. And at the same time, we have a, you know, based on our research and based on the demographics of the technician population, we have an aging workforce that is starting to retire. So we have one, you know, we have demand going up and we have supply going down, which has led to this imbalance.
And I, coming into the segment, I use the phrasing, you know, aviation mechanics, if I should be saying technicians, and tell me. And I think for audience, we need to, if we need to parse this out, let's do it. We're just talking about all the technicians. Everyone is just lumped under technicians, whether it's mechanics or any other specific jobs that we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's basically anyone who turns a wrench that works on an aircraft. And for an aircraft maintenance technician, I call them technicians, they're all licensed by the FAA. So there is schooling that they go through, there's training that they go through, and then they pass a test with the FAA to get their license, their airframe and power plant certificate. And that's really important because all the work that we do on aircraft is always to make it incredibly safe and is correct. And so we document all of the maintenance that's done, mm-hmm. and those technicians actually sign off on all the maintenance with their own certificate.
And after this segment, I'm going to have another conversation about creating, you know, a pipeline. But based on what you just said, you talked about some of the factors that are creating this problem. Is that the average age right now for someone is considered an airline mechanic is what? And we've seen that number of people leaving or retiring, but we're not replacing them. So what's the average age we're talking about here?
That's correct. So over 35% of the aircraft technicians in North America are actually over the age of 55. We first looked at this in about 2017 was the first year that I did this report. And we had forecasted that 2022, 2023 is about when we would hit supply equals demand. Mm-hmm. And what we saw over the pandemic was early retirements of technicians. And we saw the shortage kind of move up a little bit, move quicker or move to the left and happen sooner than we had anticipated. So right now, the number of technicians or the percentage of technicians that are somewhere between 18 and 30 year olds is in the single digits, right, in terms of percentage. Most of the technicians have been in the industry for 20 years or so and, you know, are going to look to retire in the next few decades.
Is in terms of technology and innovation that's also been coming online, is that also an issue too? Because we're going to be training this newer workforce with probably in a different way than we train the ones that are retiring, right? Because of technology?
It is very different. The workforce that's entering the workforce today, or the workers in the workforce today, are digital natives. They expect to see certain types of systems. They are very comfortable with augmented reality and virtual reality and new forms of training. And we are keeping up with that. I would say, you know, what is also interesting is that we have lots of new aircraft coming online, mm-hmm. that have new technology and need new types of repairs. So it's especially for folks who are training and for people who are running these technology department or these tech ops departments, it's very challenging because you can have an airplane that's 40 years old, mm-hmm. and an airplane that's 4 months old, and we need to be able to repair and maintain all of those at the same time.
And I want to talk about that in just a moment, too, because I want to shift and I want to let folks know that we reached out to a lot of airlines. We heard back from Delta. We heard back from American Airlines. We also heard back from, I think, Southwest. And listen, a lot of them said, look, we're doing our best. We're enhancing our recruiting efforts to focus on hiring recent graduates of FAA certified aviation maintenance schools. Mm-hmm. Delta talked about that they are trying to partner with transitioning military personnel, veterans, and their families, along with other initiatives. So this is a step in the right direction. But is it too late? And United also, we received a statement from United. It's a step in the right direction, but is it enough right now? Because you all are telling us it's coming. The tsunami is coming.
I would say, I mean, I would say the shortage is already here, right? When you talk to, or when I talk to people who run technology or tech ops departments, they talk about how difficult it is to attract and retain technicians. So we have a shortage now, you know, and there are many, many reasons for this, right? So for about a decade there, very few people entered the aviation market because it was a little bit stagnant there in the middle 2000s, early 2000s to the mid 2010s. We also saw fewer mechanics coming from the military, coming out of the military, which had historically been a strong pipeline. But I think the biggest thing for it is we have focused, especially at that middle school and high school, we have focused on four-year degrees and college degrees as the pinnacle or the continuing education, mm-hmm. and we haven't focused enough on trade schools and schools like FAA certified repair station or training programs that provide a wonderful career path, mm-hmm. and a wonderful career. And we haven't done enough to remind students that this is a valid option and something that can be a really, really good, rewarding life and career.
And Brian, I have a listener says, oh goodness, Rose, I'm scheduled to fly out on Wednesday. And I just said, look, you'll be all right. You'll be good. It's not going to start tomorrow that there won't be any aviation mechanics. But I want to back up because how long does it usually take for someone to become FAA certified? Could that be a deterrence for some folks too?
It depends. There are different pathways to it, but going through a certified repair program and training program, I think as your next guest will talk about, is about a 2-year process. You can also join some of these airlines as an apprentice and learn on the job as you go through, and that takes a little bit longer, but it is certainly less than a 4-year institution.
And I have another listener that has email that says, is this a job that anyone can do? And they said, I have a niece who loves aviation. And I'm not trying to say that a woman can't do this job. Do not send me an email. So are there any other challenges that you think might be part of this, you know, not having a diverse pipeline to begin with as well?
It is a great question. As we look at what folks are doing to actually address this issue, having a more diverse workforce is important. It is overwhelmingly male today. And I'm very happy to see that we have more and more women who are going through programs to become maintenance technicians. It's a more diverse workforce coming into the industry. And I think that is going to be one of the things long term that we need to work on and continue to recruit, because it is something that anyone can do, right? It is any able-bodied person can do it. And it's a very rewarding career.
Well, Brian Prentice, with a partner with management consulting company Oliver Wyman, hang with me. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about what some of these other initiatives in terms of getting folks into the industry. We'll talk to someone who runs a school. We'll talk all about this. You're listening to Closer Look. And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. As we continue today's coverage regarding the nation's aviation mechanic shortage, it's an issue that has caught the attention of Senator Raphael Warnock, who considers Georgia to be the country's most important aviation state. Now, he explained this about Georgia during a recent Commerce hearing.
Georgia's home, after all, to Delta Airlines and the world's busiest airport in Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. According to the Georgia Department of Economic Development, aerospace products are both the state's top export and its second largest manufacturing industry, one that is responsible for an annual economic impact of over $57 billion. Most importantly, Georgia's aviation industry employs more than 108,000 people spread across more than 800 different companies.
And Senator Warnock had another issue. He asked Dr. Becky Lutie about strengthening the nation's aviation workforce. Lutie is an associate professor for the Aviation Institute, housed at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and specializes in online courses as well.
Most certainly, educational institutions play a critical role. So as we've heard, one of the key areas is making sure that everybody knows we're here and that aviation is a great field to consider, and not just pilots, but across the board, introducing young people to the many different careers in aviation. We can absolutely do that through the K-12 system by introducing curriculum at a very early age in grade school. Make sure we keep students engaged with curriculum being introduced throughout. And then in the high school level, there's great high school programs that already exist, but also taking the opportunity to partner with colleges, universities, and technical programs for dual credit and other opportunities. So
with that in mind, I know what she thinks. What are schools currently doing to attract new talent? And what are the challenges? So joining the program now is Dr. Joel English. He's Executive Vice President of the Aviation Institute of Maintenance, which operates several schools across the country, including one here in Duluth. And also staying with us is Brian Prentice. He's a partner with Oliver Wyman, a management consulting company that conducted some research about the worker shortage. Dr. English, thanks for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me come on and chat about the workforce shortage, and looking forward to kind of introducing how we approach it and engage the dialogue.
Well, you heard what Dr. Betty Lutie had to say. She said, look, we need to start in K through 12. I'm going to ask you, you agree with that?
100%. That's absolutely right. And you would say, wait a minute, you're not talking about kids fixing the aircraft. Not quite. But absolutely engaging in thoughts and hands-on experience about a career in aviation is essential at a very young age. So our schools are called Aviation Institute of Maintenance. And like you said, our largest campus in Duluth, we serve Delta Airlines and all of the airline industry in Georgia. We start at very young age. We actually start aviation programming at age 12, in summer programs where students are able to come into our schools, see aircraft, actually touch them, sit in them, and engage. And that leads into a dual enrollment program where students in high school are able to, in 11th and 12th grade, actually begin their FAA certification as an aircraft mechanic. If they choose to come into our school later, then that credit transfers right into the college program.
So are you able to work with a lot of school districts or just ones up in the area where you are? Because that would, you know, if kids, let's say in Fulton or APS or DeKalb or Clayton, you know, they're way down here and Duluth is way up there. Are you able to meet, to at least get some of these students up there?
Right. When we started our dual enrollment program about 5 years ago, it really required students to be able to be bused on a daily basis to our campus. And so that's how we started this. But now we're actually developing an online program where the students can take the general aviation portion of the program partially online, where we deliver it through basically think Zoom and instruction. We send a kit of materials to the high school, even if it's a distance away, like the districts you're mentioning, and they can get their hands on in some of that. And then that limits the time that they need to be bused. We always want to make sure that there's some hands-on activity on real aircraft that the students are getting it. But through the, you know, we've all become comfortable with online technologies, and we can deliver that kind of dual enrollment program even at a distance.
And so, Dr. English, in the conversation I had with Brian, which you were listening to, we're at this crisis in terms of this shortage. If we don't start now, I mean, can we get ahead of it? Well, we're already behind, but, you know, how long would it take for us to get to where we're not having this huge demand and still a low supply of workers here?
Yeah, that's right. First of all, if the question is, when do we get to the shortage of aircraft mechanics? The answer is, on Wednesday, when your listener gets to the airport, we know that there's a good chance that there will be a flight delay.
Now, why did you say that?
I know exactly.
She's going to send me another email.
That's right. So there's a chance there will be a delay because of some kind of maintenance issue. And what she has already experienced is, hey, the price of this airline ticket that I paid for Wednesday has already gone up. So really, we're seeing the effects of the shortage right now. And yes, we can get out of it, and I'll address that.
Okay, because I'm gonna come back to that because I want to ask both of you. Another listener says, "Well, perhaps they're not paying enough." Now I don't know what that means because I'm not the expert on this. Yeah. Ryan, in your research, was compensation an issue here?
Compensation was an issue, especially for new joiners to the industry. It is a well compensated career as you get more tenure and experience in the industry. But yeah, compensation and work life balance and work rules, all sorts of things that go into what we call the value proposition for the career, were things that I think everyone is looking at today. So airlines, MROs, everyone that employs technicians are looking at all of that, and we are seeing wages starting to rise.
Now, I want to come back to you, Dr. English, because in that conversation with Brian, and we talked about how technology plays a role in this, he called this newer generation, quote, digital natives, and that right. you're going to be training people to understand how different types of plane use different types of technology. Is that what you all are doing as well? I take it.
Absolutely. At the entrance of our program, every student gets their textbooks come in a digital form. They're handed a Microsoft Surface tablet where all of the texts, all of the technologies are in there. The testing preparation program is a digital product. And a lot of the instruction that we have can simulate the different avionics on different airlines and really get their hands on in a lot of simulation ways. You're talking about that return on investment of the education. That's one of the powerful things about this. Georgia, for example, has 8 schools that teach the FAA certified program. So there are 8 different places across Georgia where a young person or frankly an older person can decide to get their education. All of those 8 schools teach toward the FAA certification to become an aircraft mechanic. And here's the great thing. It's usually less than 2 years. Our program at AIM, for example, is 20 months long. So just short of 2 years of education. And you go into a career that starts right around $60,000 at our Atlanta campus. Somewhere between $65,000 and $70,000 is a common starting salary for just 2 years of education. So
do you all guarantee placement, job placement?
So I can never say I guarantee a job placement because that requires the student to take the job and to prepare for it. But what I can say is that 72% of every graduate last year at the AIM campus in Atlanta found themselves working in an aviation career within a few months of training. So when 7 out of 10 are working as an aircraft mechanic as soon as they graduate, I say, hey, that's a great outcome for our graduates.
Joel, when you hear about a program like this and listen, 20 months, I think is what he said. Is this really then a exposure issue? And could airlines do more to encourage people to come to Dr. English's, institute?
I do think it is an exposure issue. I think it's getting people excited about the romance of aviation again and getting them into the schools. I think ideally would love to see double the number of students in these schools that Dr. English was talking about in order to help us, address the shortage that we're seeing.
And Dr. English, how diverse are the students? And are you all, do you have initiatives or you're specifically focusing on getting more women, more folks of color, folks from the rural areas, as you heard Senator Warnock talk about, what initiatives do you all have?
That is just a great question. First of all, just to look at the demographics of our students, roughly a third of our students are Caucasian, roughly a third of our students are African-American, and finally another third of Hispanic, Asian, and other mix. So an incredibly diverse student population in our schools. Your question about females in aviation is so essential. I'm gonna give you some bad news, I'm gonna give you some better news. What if I told you that only 2.5% of all working aircraft technicians are women?
That now, wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, it's bad news. And specifically because there are two things about female technicians that are extremely valuable to airlines. One, their attention to detail. Sorry if I'm going to offend the guys out there. I'm going to offend myself. The attention to detail that female mechanics have are just so very highly tuned. And I'm not exactly sure that one.
You know what? I'm just going to let you talk. I'm going to let you talk. And I'll go to it's all on you, so, brother. It's all on you.
That's right. I'm going to take the heat. What our employers, our Delta and United and American, all tell us is the female mechanics have this fine-tuned attention to detail that we need for aircraft safety. And second, the physical frames of most females are smaller frames, and they can get into tighter places than a male can. So a female technician makes a great mechanic. Mm-hmm. At our schools, about 12% of our students are female mechanics. So there's some diversity there, but we work hard to get more females interested in this awesome career path.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, representation matters. And often
right.
you want to see someone who looks like you, who
That's
is
right.
of you, teaching and maybe leading. Is that possible as well? How many of your instructors are women? And then how many folk of color do you have instructing? And I want
Absolutely.
You to
Absolutely.
And if it's an Very issue, right. you need to say that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So here's what I'm going to tell you. Our African-American instructors, our Hispanic instructors, our Puerto Rican instructors bring so much passion to the workforce. All of our instructors have at least 5 years of experience in the workforce. So my instructor base is going to look more like yesterday's aircraft mechanic than tomorrow's aircraft mechanic.
Okay.
So I've got about half Caucasian and half minority in instructors, but I'm always working to even more diversify that. Females, only about 5% of my instructors are mm-hmm. females, for the obvious reasons, because there are so few female mechanics in the past, but we're working hard to have more and more females as students, thus graduates, thus tomorrow's instructor.
What do you think you all could do better, or what other initiatives that you would like to see that perhaps aren't online right now in terms yeah. of getting more folks to come to your school so we can increase and diversify this workforce? So that all this bad news that Mr. Prentice just gave my listeners with their research, they won't yeah. have to worry about.
Let me tell you the three most important things for schools like me to be doing to better the industry and even diversify the industry. Number one, it's about youth training. Every FAA certified school needs to be offering free, that's capital F, free outreach to youth. Through summer programs, through school-based programs, to get more young people interested in aviation as a career. We're working very hard at that. Number two, it's about partnerships with the airlines and MROs, that is, partnerships that will help bring funding dollars directly to the student's pocket. Mm-hmm. An aviation maintenance program is one of the most expensive programs to offer at a community college or a technical school like mine. And so we need to be able to offset the cost of that program by having the airlines actually help fund students' programs. So I want to reduce the students' debt. Most of our schools have sponsored students, that is airlines helping pay for the tuition for the students.
That was my next question, because I have a listener just sent me an email and said, well, Rose, this is expensive, because for a lot of students, they can't afford it.
That's exactly right. So if you come to an AIM campus, yes, we will have access to federal Pell grants. That's helping with that. And we also have different student loan products. But what we try to do is reduce that student loan debt as much as possible. Mm-hmm. You're only coming to school for 20 months. So as compared to a university where you've got to fund 4 years of lifestyle along with 4 years of education, with us, it's just under 2 years of funding. But even more importantly is, how am I going to get scholarship dollars? And so United Airlines, American Airlines, Piedmont Airlines all contribute to students. And at any one of my students, I could quietly point. So these students have grants and scholarships from the airline where they will be working next. That is the most important piece to reduce college loan debt as we provide access to this great career to our graduates.
Well, Dr. Joel English and Mr. Prentice, as we wrap up, we came into this segment talking about that this was a shortage that right now you need to address. I want to end with a little bit of optimism. And so, Brian, you all mentioned this 2027, that we could really be in a jam here. But if we can take the measures now that you've been talking about and Dr. English with his schools and other institutes, we can get ahead of this at some point, right?
Absolutely. I think some of the things that Dr. English was talking about, getting to elementary school, high school age children, reminding them of what a great career this is. I think not only can we solve this, but we can ensure that, you know, we still have a very reliable and wonderful aviation system in North America, as well as provide great careers for a significant number of people in the U.S. So I'm very positive. I'm super excited about this and look forward to, you know, working within the industry to make this happen for the next couple of years.
And Dr. Joel English, I'll give you the last word. Where are we headed?
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that the one of the best things going on in our country is the whole dialogue about the value of a college education. I am a product of the university system. I've got three college degrees, but I will tell you, finally, we're having the conversation that Brian alluded to earlier, saying, what is the value? How do I want to make a return on that investment? And finally, we're looking for technical programs like the Aviation Maintenance Technician Program as a great answer to the college value. How can I get a certification that will lead to a lifelong employment? And aviation maintenance is absolutely that.
Dr. Joel English, Executive Vice President of the Aviation Institute of Maintenance, which operates several schools across the country, including one here in our Duluth area. Also, Brian Prentice, partner with the Oliver Wyman, the management consulting company that conducted the research about the aviation mechanic shortage. Thank you both for taking the time. Good conversation. Lots of emails. Let's get some folks in the industry.
Thank you so much.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. In 2022, domestic and imported wine sales topped off at $66.97 billion. Ooh, that's a lot of money. That's according to a wine market size share and trends analysis report. That's perhaps good news. But perhaps what's not good news is the wine industry lacks diversity, equity, and inclusion. There's a problem there. Data reveals that there are more than 11,000 wineries in the nation, but just over 130 of them are Black-owned. Black-owned wineries account for less than 1%. So, yeah, do the math on that. This is all while Black people make up more than 10% of wine consumers in the U.S. We like wine, too. So, through education, exposure, and mentorship, my next guests are working to bridge the wine industry's diversity gap. The nonprofit The Roots Fund, which helps Black and brown people pursue careers in wine-related fields, has opened a scholarship for Metro Atlanta residents. And joining me now to talk about this initiative is Ikemi DuBose-Woodson, the CEO and co-founder of The Roots Fund, and Aaron Monu, the co-founder of Wines for the Culture and a Roots Fund scholar. Thank you all for taking the time. Red or white, where are we going? I'll start with you, Aaron. You're here in the studio. I came across this from the Wine Industry Advisor. It said, quote, at this point, the fact that the wine industry needs a fresh perspective is old news. And it goes on to say, the numbers are stark. It talks about less than 1% of wineries in the U.S. are owned by Black people. And that perhaps, maybe folks don't feel like there is space to be on the other side of the drinking glass, so to speak, which is the industry. You think that's a deterrent for some folks who want to get into the wine industry?
I definitely believe so. I believe us not seeing each other in a space like that is a deterrent. I mean, for a lot of things, right? For most industries, if we don't see us, we don't believe we can do it. So yes, it is a deterrent, but I think there's a few other factors as well that deter us.
Ikemi, what do you think? Is that representation matters, right?
Representation does matter, but it's also not been directly guided towards us as a possibility. So when you're in school, you have career day, doctors come, lawyers come, maybe a journalist, it kind of streamlines what we're capable of and what we can do. Mm-hmm. So I think that a lot of it is just that lack of exposure. So that is more deterring than the lack of representation.
Well, let me stay with you for a moment, because much like with the segment I just had as it relates to aviation mechanics, is it that folks need to know that there are some great careers within this industry beyond, you know, maybe being a a bottler or you know, working out in California at a vineyard or somewhere, or up in North Georgia? Is that really that folks need to know? What are these opportunities?
Yeah, I mean, there is a little bit of everything in wine. We are some of the largest consumers of alcohol, period, in the U.S., beyond the wine industry.
Yeah.
But when you go into our communities, there's a billboard every other block, but it's featuring a spirit. Hennessy, Ciroc, things like that. So we tend to gravitate to it versus having a wine bar or a wine shop in our neighborhood. So we don't really know that there are careers and things that correlate with everything that we do and just business that reflect the wine industry.
How'd you get into it? What led you to this space?
For me, I'm a chef by trade. You know, that's where I started out. Suffered an injury in the kitchen that led me to the front of the house. And I realized, hey, you can dress up out here. You work less hours and you make more money. Maybe I'm in the wrong part of this space. So just seeing people enjoy, and I think it was always heartwarming to me to see people look like me in a dining room when they saw someone like me in a management position out front. It always made that experience a little bit better.
And Aaron, you're the co-founder of Wines for the Culture and a Roots Fund scholar. What led you to this space?
Oh, man. Well, like a lot of people, the pandemic, right? So we were just bored, we were drinking, but I think more deeply than that, it was this longing to learn something new. You know, that was a big reset for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people had to decide if what they were doing was going to make sense in their life. So for us, when we started Wines for the Culture, it was just that. It was just exploration. I mean, even down to when I became a scholar, it was still a lot of exploration, trying to see what life looked like with this new pandemic world and who I was. So it was a lot about identity.
What'd you learn? As a scholar, I mean, you got a smile on your face. If our listeners could see, it opened up a whole new world for you, huh?
Yeah. Well, I learned so much about wine in general, right? I think that was the biggest thing. The first time I drank wine, oh my gosh, hope my mom doesn't hear this, but she gave me a glass of wine when I was like seven.
That's okay. That's mom. Actually, well, you know, in some countries, but go ahead.
Well, so she was trying to deter me, right? You know, she had me try like whiskey as well, and like, she was trying to be like, hey, look, like, don't, this is bad stuff. Like, gotcha. You're just sip, you're going to hate it. And I had the wine and I liked it. So, I mean, I kind of always was drawn to wine, but even in my prior profession, I drank a lot of wine, but I didn't know a lot about it. So with the Roots Fund, what was the biggest thing was just learning about what wine was, but then learning about all the facets of wine. I mean, it's deep. You had mentioned before the situation about, you know, wineries and that being the main job. There's so much more.
Well, so much more. So, Kimmy, you heard what Aaron said. How often do you hear that from folks that come into the program and say, wow, I didn't know all this was happening in the industry?
For sure. I mean, I think the most common thing that you do hear is that people become almost afraid of it because they haven't had access to it. They don't know how to do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what that means. And they work in corporate spaces, office spaces where you're out dining, you got to pick out a wine. You want to go to a friend's house, you stop by the market to pick out a wine, and they just don't know how to do it. So I think that we've created this room where there isn't a such thing as a stupid question, but more of keep asking questions so that you become more knowledgeable and confident.
And so with the Roots Fund, where does it all begin? Folks just apply? How does all this work?
Well, we do scholarships 3 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's best to join our mailing list, get on our social media. We always kind of give a heads up when it's happening. It goes usually a 2 to 3 week period. And through that process, they're interviewed. You get to actually talk to our educational director or someone on our team. And we try to find the best fit for you, making sure that you understand the commitment to the organization, that you have the time and the work ethic to put in to really go far in the space.
And when folks, as they are taking the I won't call them courses, but as they're being educated, what do you notice about them? What kind of changes do you see? You see more confidence in them about just not only understanding the industry, but understanding wines.
For sure. My dad said it to me last night in Atlanta that I'm making all of our people extra bougie with all of this wine programming.
Oh, come on now, Dad. Black folk been drinking wine for a long time, Dad. I get it.
There we go. It's just about them feeling super confident, you know, going into those spaces where there are, you know, where they're outweighed by a large amount of white people who may have had access to wine their entire life. So going into those spaces, having the confidence, understanding what they're talking about, and being able to carry on a conversation, I think goes a long way.
And let me ask you both this, and I'll start with you, Aaron. If you have, if we have more diversity, equity, and inclusion in the wine industry, that that helps overall, right? I mean, do you think that there's maybe people say, well, you know, you can't force this on anybody, but look, diversity, it's needed, right?
I mean, I would agree. You can't force it on people, right? But at the end of the day, when we have that diversity, that equity, and that inclusion in this space, it allows our people to expand our palates, both literally and figuratively, to see other parts of the world, experience other cultures, and just to grow as a people.
And what kind of jobs are we also talking about, too, that folks may not think about when we talk about the wine industry? What do you share with them?
For sure. I mean, think about everything in business. So wine, just like a spirit, it needs to be marketed. Mm-hmm. You need journalists around it. You need lawyers to make sure you're following the alcohol and spirits law. And journalism goes in so many ways. Radio shows, podcasts, social media influencers, so many ways, magazines, newspaper articles. Surprisingly, people do still read the news. So you still need folks in that space, as well as hospitality. You know, I think we see hospitality and we think a hotel or a restaurant, but there are so many aspects of hospitality within the wine space. And then they need people who are brand ambassadors. That's a very big portion of wine sales that allows you to travel the world, drink lots of wine, make content. Everyone's always looking for the newest thing to draw in a new demographic. Because I tell everyone now, the old white man is dying who used to buy all the wine.
All right.
Well, so now you need... you need a different demographic to come in and start securing those same types of bottles and having those same experiences. So you need to grasp them and meet them at their level.
Well, let's just use me as an example. Let's just say Rose Scott is going to become an ambassador for wine. Okay, Aaron, so where do you want me? You want me in Merlot? Riesling's too sweet. I'm a sweet person, but Riesling is just too sweet. I haven't found a perfect Riesling. Where do you want to put me? I'm a brand ambassador. Where do you want to put me?
So you're a brand ambassador for wine. So where am I putting you in the marketplace, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, but you've only met me for a few moments, but you know my personality, like, you know.
Okay. I mean, listen, you want something bubbly, I think. I think something a little bright. Okay. But something that's going to bring energy to what you already have, because you have great energy.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
All right. Well, what do you think? Energy?
Yeah. I mean, for starters, Rieslings can be very dry. Most of them are not sweet.
Really?
But I think a lot of times we just see sweet ones in our market. Riesling.
So in other words, I don't know what I'm doing is what you're saying.
No, it's okay, but that perfectly goes with what we're talking about today, Rose. Like, this is what's been exposed to us. So this may be what we know about it and kind of gravitate to. But I'll go with Aaron, you know, sparkling champagne, big market for that. They love, and over there in Champagne, they enjoy all people drinking bubbles. Like, it is just an experience in itself.
And, you know, also sometimes there is a bit of intimidation because you go out to dinner with folks and my friends who are listening, you know who you are. There's someone that says, I'll pick the wine because we're having salmon and we're going to have, and I need a dessert wine. You know, and I don't know. I just go with the flow. So what's the common mistake you think people make about ordering a wine with the dinner?
I think a lot of people look at the prices.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
We definitely go into that heavily. I think sometimes I have it all the time with our celebrity supporters who reach out to us. They see the high price and think that's the best wine. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times that's completely wrong. Mm. There are a lot of great wines at very great prices. I think it's more about thinking about what you like. Like, what do you like to taste? What flavors resonate with you? And if you go to a great restaurant, the person that's selling you the wine, the sommelier should be able to ask you those questions. Like, what flavors?
Sure.
Mean a lot to you, and what can we add to this experience, and what wine can we select around those flavors?
I have a listener who says, does the older that the wine in terms of its bottling, does that mean it's automatically going to be better?
Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of times you can buy wine and open it and it's corked or it's bad because it's laid down for too long. But vintage wines, of course, are always desired. They have, you know, longer history, longer legacy. You can trail it back to a story, and people are often infatuated with that and they want to try the wines. But not necessarily. There are a lot of young wines right now that are very drinkable that have come out in the last 2 or 3 years that are very affordable and very tasty.
And so, Aaron, when you co-founded Wines for the Culture, you know, what's your one takeaway that you want folks to know as they enter into this space and they become part of your wheelhouse, so to speak.
Yeah, one thing that I want people to know, I want people to know that there's a wine for everybody. You know, I feel like some people, they don't drink wine because they feel like they've had a bad experience a couple of times and mm-hmm. there's nothing for them. But, I mean, there is literally a wine for everybody. You can go as granular as you want with wine, from the region to the varietal to the production, how it's made.
You mentioned region.
Yeah.
What do you, we only got a few minutes, but what is it about Atlanta's? Does Atlanta's wine region have some identity, or we just out here floating all, just just dangling? We all over the place.
Yeah, you know, I think Atlanta's wine community is definitely growing, right? I think it's just like any other industry. So it's almost like an emerging industry here.
Right.
Yeah, there's a lot of room for growth, and there's a lot of people who are really pushing the narrative forward. It's nice.
All right. I can maybe real quickly, how can folks learn more about the Roots Fund?
Definitely. Head to our website, www.therootsfund.org. Go to our Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. We have a scholarship open right now for Georgia residents only. It will be open till next Monday, and it's a great way for you to integrate with the community. If you don't know yet what you want, you can apply for a community scholarship, and we'll help you figure it out once you get inside. So right. We have something for everybody.
I love it. Ikemi Dubose-Woodson, the CEO and co-founder of the Roots Fund, and Aaron Monu, the co-founder of Wines for the Culture and a Roots Fund scholar. Thank you both so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. I am going to up my wine game tremendously. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for this edition of Closer Look. Our producers are LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Our supervising producer is Tiffany Griffith. Our engineer is Sawyer Vanderworth. Let me know your thoughts on today's program. Send me an email, because you already have, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of this, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. Catch our rebroadcast tonight at 7, and we have a podcast, so subscribe wherever you like. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE. Coming out of Atlanta, I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WABE politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.